make him an offer again with you.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
Well, hello to everybody out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network and another episode of Front Row Classics. I'm your host, Brandon Davis, and joining me is once again is my co-host, Eric Flick. How's it going, Eric?
Good. How are you, Brandon?
Oh, not too bad, not too bad. Spring is in the air, and Easter's right around the corner, and it's interesting, the sort of, you know, every Christmas, you know, we talk about the list of Christmas movies. Easter, there's not very many, and during the Easter holiday, people like to show biblical epics, and yep. We're going to show the biblical epic of all biblical epics, I think we're going to do.
Maybe one of two, right? There's two biggies.
One of two, actually, yeah. There's another one that gets shown on network TV still every Easter that yeah. We will probably have to talk about at some point. But we're talking about Ben-Hur from 1959, a landmark in movie history. Still to this day, and you and I are going to get into it, but just hard to believe that they were able to accomplish what they were able to accomplish in 1959. But before we do first impressions, do you want to give people a plot synopsis?
Oh, I'll do my best here. All right. I've got two pages of plot synopsis written out. I may need to have an intermission like there exists in the middle of Ben-Hur because this is an epic. This is a long movie. And it's the story of Judah Ben-Hur, who's a Jewish prince living right around the time of Jesus Christ. So it's biblical times, New Testament biblical times, though. And Judah lives with his mother and his sister in occupied Judea, which is occupied by Rome. Early on in the movie, we see that one of his friends growing up, named Messala, is actually a Roman aristocrat and gets promoted to become second in charge of occupied Judea. So there's a little scene where the two friends meet each other. They sort of reminisce about old times and then have a little bit of a disagreement too about the politics of how Judea is being occupied by the Romans. And then we cut to a few days later when the new governor of Judea is coming into town and he's celebrating with a parade. Judah Ben-Hur's family is watching the parade. He and his sister are watching, particularly from the rooftop of their house, where his sister slips, knocks a tile from the slate roof, which coincidentally falls onto the governor and injures him pretty grievously. This is a big crime in ancient Roman times. Judah takes the fall for it too. And instead of helping out his old friend, Messala, the Roman through and through, decides to use this as an opportunity to consolidate his power over Judea, to raise his standing in the empire, and has Judah convicted. As Judah is leaving the town, he's treated worse than other slaves, probably because of his position that he had. And we do see that they travel to the town of Nazareth, and a mysterious figure there gives him a drink of water. But the next thing we know, he had been convicted of being a criminal and serves as a slave rowing oars on Roman galleys, does this for years until finally he is on a ship that is the command ship of a fleet that's been tasked to wipe out some Macedonian pirates that had been plaguing Roman village seaports and the Roman fleet. So a large sea battle ensues. Prior to the battle, though, the commander of the ship, the commander of the fleet, had noticed that Judah Ben-Hur was a sort of a fiery character and has him unchained before the battle begins. Eventually, the ship that they're on gets rammed and boarded. Judah, being free, manages to escape and free all the other slaves that are in the galley. Makes his way to topside, where he sees the Roman governor, the commander of the fleet, in trouble, and saves his life by removing him from the ship. Eventually, they are shipwrecked. They get picked up by another Roman fleet, informed that the battle was won. So the Roman commander's a big hero, and he takes Judah Ben-Hur back to Rome, where he eventually names him his heir, the heir to his lands. Which Judah accepts for a little while, stays there and seems to be somewhat happy, but eventually he decides that he has to return back to Judea. On the way there, he is waylaid a little bit by an Arab that he runs across that is training a 4-team horse chariot. And we learn that Judah had raced horses in the Roman circus. And is very knowledgeable about this, demonstrates his knowledge to this Arab, who asks Judah to then lead his team of horses in an upcoming race, which just happens to have Messala leading a team of undefeated horses there as well. Judah's informed, too, that kind of anything goes during one of these chariot races. So we cut to that next big scene where Messala shows up. He's got a chariot that he's equipped with these spikes on the edges of the wheels. The race starts, and Messala takes out several of the other charioteers with those spiked wheels. But eventually, his chariot gets caught up with Judah's and falls apart. Messala falls to the ground, is dragged by some horses, and trampled by a team fatally. So he ends up dying in the camp outside the races, but is visited by Judah prior to his leaving, who's now got vengeance on his enemy and can go home. So he arrives back in Judea to find his old home had largely been abandoned, although a former slave that he had an infatuation with before he had been convicted of his crime still remains at his home, and they've sort of rekindle a romance that they had previously had. And Judah comes to find out from her that his mother and his sister had been in prison and are now dead. Only we find out that his paramour, the slave, had been lying to protect Judah from the fact that they were in fact lepers in a local leper colony. And then we cut to, the trial of Jesus Christ. So Judah eventually goes and gathers his family and removes them from the leper colony, and they sort of stumble their way back to Judea, where the trial of Jesus is going on. Pontius Pilate is overseeing the trial, and they witness Jesus being convicted and marching to the crucifixion site. They witness the crucifixion. And the moment that Jesus dies, we actually see that Judah's mother and sister have been miraculously healed from their leprosy. Judah has come to realize that this is the same individual that gave him a drink when he was a slave. Judah tried to repay Jesus in the same way by offering him water, and Judah has now become a follower of Christ as well. And that is the movie in a nutshell. How'd I do?
You did pretty well. You did pretty well. I'm going to, I'll give you a little chance to do a little breather before we do first impressions. I'll do just a bit of a background on this movie because it's a long background. I mean, this is based off of a novel that was written back in 1880, by a man named General Lew Wallace, who was a Civil War hero. And, wasn't a believer or anything when he wrote this. It was just, a story that kind of fascinated him. I know a lot of people over the years have speculated whether Judah Ben-Hur was real. He's not. It's the same storytelling format, like Scarlett O'Hara and Gone with the Wind or Jack Dawson and Titanic. This is a fictional character that the author has made a witness to something historical. Right. And so in popular novel, although it's interesting, I was listening to just some commentaries and things in an old interview with Charlton Heston, and he even said, you know, the book itself is not very good, but the he said, in terms of the way it was written, he said, but the story, the plot was wonderful. So it actually became like a stage version of some in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and they actually used treadmills and you know and pulled these chariots with real horses, and it became big live spectacles. And then very important in the studio that's behind this movie, MGM's history, it was the first major hit that MGM ever had, because this movie's a remake of a silent version made in 1925, and Ben-Hur, the silent version, is what put MGM on the map. And so now we're in the late 50s and MGM's in trouble. They've Louis B. Mayer was, you know, ousted because of a coup, you know, in the early 50s, and it has gone through multiple studio heads. They haven't had as many hits as they have, and so they need something, and so they gamble everything on a movie that, you know, put them on the map, you know, 30 years before. So it, you know, who knew that this was going to be, you know, sort of the salvation of a studio. But yeah, everything about it is huge, and we're going to get into it. But Eric, we'll start with you. What are your first impressions of Ben-Hur?
Yeah, I mean, you just said it right there. Everything is huge. This is truly an epic in the purest sense of the word. This movie, it's larger than life in a lot of ways, but it's also got some real grounded moments and some real grounded performances in it. Here's my big secret, though. I've never really liked this movie. Mm. I'm not a real big fan of Charlton Heston and his acting, but it's also like it's certainly one of the best epics of all time. It's just it's a good movie. And it's got to be on a must watch list. You have to witness what these filmmakers actually did.
Mm-hmm. I think this movie is definitely the best of its type. We sort of alluded to the beginning, like the other well-known movie of this genre is The Ten Commandments, and that movie is directed by Cecil B. DeMille, and DeMille really love to go even more over the top. And, you know, his movies are so full of everything, and they, you know, the 3.5 hours of a DeMille movie sometimes can be very daunting. This movie is directed by one of the all-time great directors of not just the golden age, but any age, William Wyler, who could direct anything. And apparently Charlton Heston in the interview said the reason Wyler took this project was it's the only genre he really hadn't directed at that point.
Wow.
He had done dramas, romantic comedies, westerns, everything else. And he said, you know, I need to tackle an epic. And he definitely was up to the challenge. But yeah, this movie is big in every way. Even its leading man is big in every way, and we'll get into that. But it's very, very artfully done, and for such a big movie, it has a lot of really small character moments in the movie that really grounds it and really, I think, makes it a step above the rest.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that it paces them in a way too that, you know, this movie could have been all battles and chariot races and crucifixions, and it's not. It's got those moments in it, and they're picked out very carefully. That's not the majority of this movie, and it's not like other epics that we've talked about too. You know, there's Spartacus is just it moves sort of quickly through battle scene to battle scene, and a lot more action. Even Patton, that we just recently discussed, a lot more of that. This movie's got a lot of more tender moments in between.
This movie makes you care about the characters, and that's why when you get to the larger moments, there's more at stake. and there's more humanity involved. Let's start. We'll get into individual scenes later, but we do have to start with Charlton Heston, who, you know, I think is probably more well known for this type of genre than any other actor. He just, you know, he looked like he was carved out of granite. He looked like he could have been. And I can't think of any other actor that played more, you know, like historical figures in his life. I mean, from, you know, he played Andrew Jackson, he played Michelangelo, he played, you know, John the Baptist, he played Moses, he played, Mark Anthony. I mean, he played so many different kinds, and he just fits so well. Whereas, even if you're not totally a fan of his acting, he fits so much better in the genre than, you know, other actors of that time would. If you think about, if you put like, well, and they did in an earlier movie, if you put Paul Newman into something like this, Paul Newman's just going to look silly, I think. But Heston really fits that mold, I think. And he really, because he's dealing with larger than life events. And so his sort of larger than life persona, I think, fits this better than others.
Yeah. And I think that's a great way to put it. I mean, it feels, the thing I don't like about the performance, and it's my personal small grudge, it feels like every line is delivered like, well, like, get your hands off me, you damn dirty ape, and Soylent Green is people. I mean, which are the other two sort of science fiction movies that he's known for. It feels like everything he does has that sort of gravitas behind it. And I think you're right, though. It fits best in a movie like this, where he is he's up against these larger than life forces, and the story's larger than life, and he kind of goes with it. So it's not to the point where it's jarring and it takes you out of the movie. And he does do a good job too of having these really tender moments, especially sort of the brotherly moments between the Ben-Hur and the Masala characters. Those are really, really well done, and Charlton Heston can get to that vulnerable place. He definitely is, though, a larger-than-life actor and character in this movie, but it's watchable. It's not something that takes you out of it. And the guy got the Academy Award. I mean, he certainly was recognized for this performance.
Well, and yeah, and he really does go on an arc through this. I mean, he's not the same person he is at the beginning, and you do see that evolution more than you would in, you know, other movies of this kind. And I think, and we talked about it before, it's because of the smaller moments, and it's because of the people he gets to interact with. And you know, certainly, I mean, he probably deserved the Oscar just for physically being put through the ringer like he is in this movie.
But back to that arc of that character, though, it's a very long arc. For the majority of this movie, that character's motivated by revenge, which isn't inherently likable, and eventually gets it. I mean, he kills his enemy, but there's this redemption arc to him at the end too that is really powerful as well.
Yeah, and he does, and I think it takes a director like Wyler who was able to rein him in for those smaller moments, whereas other directors, I think, a lot of times just sort of let him go and do his own Heston thing. Yeah. But I think when you have someone who is of the caliber of a William Wyler, you can get that performance out of him. And you're right. He is really, especially in the beginning, during just those two-person scene with him and Stephen Boyd, who we'll talk about soon, as Masala. But you feel the brotherly love between them in the beginning, and of course it just crumbles right before you, in the opening segments. But yeah, and he does a lot in this movie, you know, without dialogue. I mean, there's long sections of this movie where there's no dialogue. I think in, you know, stuff like the galley scenes, and a lot of the events that are happening are written on his face, and he's animated enough to convey that.
Absolutely. And he's doing it through really, you mentioned it, really torturous physical things that he has to do too. So, I mean, that is definitely a skill that not many actors would have. I mean, to be able to be pulling on that oar, I don't know how real that was or how heavy it was, but it sure looks painful when he's doing it, and you believe it. I mean, you're right there with him during any of those very physical scenes.
Mm-hmm. Well, now we're going to move on to the, you mentioned kind of your gripe is with Heston. We're going to go on to my gripe in this movie a little bit, which is Stephen Boyd, who I think is a fine actor who plays Masala. My gripe, and it confirmed it when I watched this, I don't see him as a physically imposing equal to Heston. He seems a little too boyish for me. I feel like had they cast, you know, and the part's not big enough to have cast a star of the equal caliber of Heston, but if you were to cast, you know, someone of the same build and of the same height and of maybe of the same charisma, you know, you might be a little more afraid of Masala as an audience member, but most of the time you just see him as like a whiny little boy. But I think Boyd does fine and he's a good actor, but I think the casting might have been wrong.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, he certainly doesn't match Heston physically. Very few people probably do. You know, the thing that I did get from the performance, what I did and I didn't get was Masala's treacherous. Mm-hmm. You know, we mentioned that some of the best scenes that Heston has is when they're friendly toward each other. You get that friendliness from Boyd, but you don't necessarily get that sort of greasy treacherousness. There's never that thing. It kind of surprises you that he could turn on his friend. And then the characters just like that for the rest of the movie. And it's maybe a little bit of a flaw in the script, but the performance itself is, like you said, it's kind of okay. Mm-hmm. I do really appreciate that. You know, one of the more difficult scenes that I'm sure we'll get to, that actor had to be all made up as a bloody mess and deliver some very powerful lines.
He gives one of the best death scenes of all time.
That is a great performance there. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate that it takes you 2/3 of the movie or longer to get there. Mm-hmm. And have that character emote in such a way.
I do like him in the beginning, you know, when before his relationship with Judah has just deteriorated, because you can see, you know, why, you know, especially like when he's interacting with Miriam and Tirza, the mother and the sister, of why he was so welcome in their home as a young boy, and you can see, you know, the likability factor before, you know, power corrupted him. Mm-hmm. And I think that was an important, you know, the important couple of scenes for us to see, so that, you know, he's not this one note mustache twirling villain the whole time.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. For me, though, I think what makes this movie so great is it's an outstanding supporting cast of wonderful character actors in this movie. And we'll just mention a few, and we'll get into more when we talk about the actual scenes. But I love Jack Hawkins, who plays Arius, the Roman general that ends up adopting Ben-Hur. And he's not in very much of the movie. He's in the, you know, the middle and the end of the first act, basically. But he has such a presence about him. And when he first enters, you know, he's this, you know, this very authoritarian Roman figure, and, you know, and little by little it gets chipped away and he gets humanized more and more as the time goes on. And I love the relationship that he and Judah build together. And I think the scenes with him and Heston are some of the other best scenes in the movie, especially when, you know, they first meet in like his quarters and he's shocked that Judah didn't, you know, kill him when he had the chance and all of that. But yeah, and another actor who can do so much without, you know, moving a muscle, basically.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I love that. That's how we're introduced to the character. And you mentioned that he's got this presence. You can tell that he goes down into the galley of that ship and all eyes are on him, and his eyes are singularly focused on Heston's character. And it's just a great introduction to that character, who then gets some of the best dialogue scenes where between he and Heston, and some of the only jokes go on when they're on the raft, where he's asks, "Why did you save me?" And Heston's character says something like, "Row well and you will be rewarded," or something like that, what he was told when he was a slave. Mm-hmm. And then you get the genuine fatherly attitude. I mean, he mentioned several times how his son has passed and he now thinks of Judah Ben-Hur as his son. And they're really touching moments. And you're right, small part, and almost wish we could see more. I mean, what happens to that character? What happens when he hears that, you know, Judah has won the chariot race and is, you know, now in Judea again. So, well acted for it. Good actors take a small part and make you remember it and make you believe it. And that is exactly what was going on there.
Yeah. And I love his, you know, his, one of his opening lines to Judah, you know, where he says, you know, your eyes are full of hate, you know, hate's good. It keeps a man alive. It gives him strength.
Yeah.
And he delivers that stuff so well. It's almost Shakespearean the way he delivers it.
Yes. Yeah.
And, but you're right. And I love, he has such warmth later on after that. You realize, you know, this is a man who, like Judah, kind of life is kicked around a little bit, and they both kind of share that in common as well. Another great supporting performance in the movie, and the other Oscar-winning performance in the movie, is Hugh Griffith as a Sheik Ilderim, who provides kind of he's kind of the comic relief of the movie. And
yeah,
well, once again, he's not in it very much, but boy, he makes his mark once he's on screen. And he's kind of the one who sort of propels the plot into the second act, and, you know, and gives us, you know, what we need to have the climax of the movie. You know, the chariot race wouldn't happen without him.
No, absolutely. It's a good point or a good time to point out, though, that the character's is problematic. So it's a stereotypical sort of Arab trader character that wasn't right at the time. You know, we can argue up and down about what to do with those now, but it exists. It's in this movie. That being said, and we acknowledge that it was problematic even in 1959. It should have probably been handled a different way. It is well acted. This is a well acted role. This is an affable character. Lines delivered with this subtext to them too, that you have this character that's telling jokes or is interacting with Roman gamblers in a way that he knows that they think less of him, and he knows that he's got an advantage over them. So I don't think, and Brandon, I don't want to speak for you, but I don't think you think either, that it was ever the filmmaker's intention to have this character be a negative character in any way. In fact, I think they were trying to say that the Arabs of that time were an oppressed people too, and this guy represented the best of them. And so I think it's actually a positive character in some ways.
There's a lot of subtext with his character, especially at the beginning of Act Two, when he is, wagering with all the Roman, with all the Roman generals and everything. And, and his entourage that's with him, they cut to facial expressions of some of his entourage and everything when they can see what's going on. And I think almost his character, it's kind of where he almost feels like he has to present this sort of over the top stereotype because that's what they expect of him. And that's how he's going to survive in this world.
Yeah.
And you're right. And, you know, the character is stereotypical, and also, you know, it's a Welsh actor portraying
painted to look much darker.
It's the same thing 3 years later in another great movie, Lawrence of Arabia. Alec Guinness plays the same similar kind of character, and he wears the same kind of tropical makeup, they called it back then.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's an unfortunate, you know, thing that was common at the time, but he plays it incredibly well. Hugh Griffith's a wonderful actor, and he definitely makes the most of it. It's interesting, though, we'll allude a little bit to the remake later, but the remake from 2016, Morgan Freeman plays this part in the movie. So even Morgan Freeman is not quite, so it's not even quite the right nationality for the part either. But But looking at some of the other supporting characters in the movie, though, I think Martha Scott and Kathy O'Donnell as Miriam and Tirza do a good job. They're very affable and warm in their opening scenes. And then, of course, they get to really delve, you know, pretty dark in the later scenes, you know, having to betray people suffering from leprosy. And I think they do a pretty good job.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, they're again not given a huge amount to do. They're there at the beginning, and then at the end, they're really impactful. But their screen time is a lot lower than some of the other characters. Certainly, a lot lower than Charlton Heston's character in the 100% of this film.
Yeah, and then taking a look, also Sam Jaffe, who does a wonderful job as Simonides, who is the father of Esther, who was a slave and the love interest of Charlton Heston in the movie, who's played by Haya Hararit, who is an Israeli actress. And I think, you know, I wish she had done more movies, because I think she does a really good job in this movie, and she has really good chemistry with Charlton Heston, which I feel like would have been difficult, because Heston a lot of times always seemed to me to perform in kind of a vacuum, so it would be hard to have chemistry, but she breaks that barrier, and she really does a good job.
Yeah, I think she does. That's kind of one of my other gripes about this, is like there's a piece of that story that just kind of falls flat, and you know they kind of end up together, but there's never really that moment of true passion between the two, or maybe I just didn't get enough of that from those scenes where it's just Judah and Esther together after he returns home. There's certainly a chemistry before he is convicted and goes away, and she's being betrothed to another man, and you know he's her master, and there's this weird sort of he had never noticed her before, and there's definitely an attraction and a chemistry there, and it's just not as strong in the second half of the movie for me.
Mm-hmm. She is kind of the, especially at the very end of the movie, she's the catalyst of, you know, him sort of making his moral turn. And we'll definitely talk about that later. And, you know, other wonderful supporting characters, you know, that we can also talk about. I also like Finley Curry as Balthazar. I think he delivers a very, once again, just like a lot of these, you know, British actors who come in to do small parts, but you remember them because they're so solid. Mm-hmm. And he delivers some wonderful lines of dialogue, and he has some wonderful moments as well, which we'll talk about. But let's actually get into talking about the bulk of the movie and talking about actual sequences and scenes. The prologue for this movie, I thought, is always interesting. And it's funny, I was reading, the movie got re-released 10 years later in the late 60s, and then we'll talk about box office later, but did great box office, but theater owners wanted to shorten it so they could show more, screenings of the movie, and they cut the prologue out. And just started it with because that even starts even before the title credits. And it's beautifully done.
Yeah, and I didn't talk about that as part of the plot here. And maybe we should kind of revisit, for those who aren't as familiar with the film, what those are. You know, the prologue and then a couple of other scenes are taken directly from the New Testament.
It's basically the prologue is basically the Christmas story.
Indeed.
It's,
yeah.
And the funny thing is, like, and it's so artistically done the way Wyler does it. He really never, no one ever mentions these people by name. You know, you just, it's the beginning, it's Mary and Joseph, and all you hear is Joseph's name. And you hear that they're headed to Bethlehem. And then, you know, we get to the nativity, and we see the wise men come, and, you know, Balthazar, who's our connection to later in the movie. But it's
yeah, and he's one of the magi that shows up.
One of the three wise men. Yeah. And mm-hmm. he is, it's beautifully shot. It's beautifully, the colors are wonderful in it, and it's very, very peaceful without much dialogue at all. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like a silent movie. It's so gorgeous. Yeah. And, backed up by, you know, something which we should, you know, definitely give credit to, the score in this movie by Miklos Roza, one of the great film composers of all time. And this is a mammoth score, and he does a brilliant job.
I mean, scoring an epic's just got to be insane, but this one's got so many different movements to it, and mm-hmm. you have these peaceful and quiet scenes too that are scored really well. And yeah, it would be a big miss not to mention that. It's a tremendous score.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on though. What's one of your favorite sequences in the movie?
So I'll save the big one here for later on down the road, but you know, I do think that Charlton Heston defying the slavery captivity, anytime that he can look defiant, he's sort of in his best form.
That's his element.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a great scene where he's been convicted of hitting the governor with a tile, and he's chained to several other slaves, and they're led out of the capital of Judea, and they go through, I think it's actually Nazareth is the, and I may have said Bethlehem earlier, but it's Nazareth that they go through, and he is absolutely defiant, and he's treated the worst. He's beat up by the guards, and then they're all drinking water, and you see this figure give him water, but you never see his face. And you mentioned it too. They never mention who these characters are. We know that this is running parallel to the biblical story of Christ. And we know that's Jesus giving him the water, but the fact that the choice that the director made to never say that, and to have this moment of this defiant character being helped by this other individual, and the piece that really gets me in it is the guards' reactions when they see this, and they see sort of the humanity behind it. It just reminds you, the watcher, that everybody's a human, you know, and this is that, I think that even resonates today in 2021, when we talk about things like police brutality or just plain violence in the streets. I mean, that's the number one rule, right? Is treat your brothers like you would want to be treated yourself, and that's the golden rule. So that scene has it right there for me, and I think that's a really powerful and important scene.
It's kind of important to note, I think William Wyler was one of the five movie directors that went overseas during World War II to shoot sort of documentary films, and I believe Wyler is one of those directors that was there during the liberation of Dachau, and came back and spoke about, you know, how changed he was after he had seen that. And so from then on, most of his movies are about the underdog and about you know, overcoming persecution and things like that, and he infuses so much of that into this movie. And you know, this is only 14 years after World War II, so you know, it's still so fresh for so many people. And so, you know, this whole movie's about, you know, you know, persecuted people. You know, we mentioned, you know, the Jews, and we mentioned, you know, the Arabs, and some, you know, so many others. And so he infuses sort of that, you know, as you said, the golden rule aspect to this movie, and you know, grace and mercy and generosity.
Yeah.
I love that scene too. The guard's expression is so good. And then I noticed this time watching it, when he gives Heston the water, Heston's water never runs out. He just keeps on drinking. And, you know, that's
just a little touch that would make you think, oh, this is miraculous. I hadn't noticed that. That's news to me. That's great.
Yeah. For me, we'll talk about, you know, one of the big scenes, but the whole galley sequence and the whole, sea battle to me is just outstanding. I love the way that Wyler shoots that galley scene, and with Rose's score, and the way that you know, the whoever the guy is who keeps time with the with the guys in the galley, and the way that everything just sort of fuses together, and there's so much tension in there, and there's so you just feel for these guys, and they're so, you can just imagine how uncomfortable it is, and how, you know, just awful it's been all these years for Judah, and there's so much suspense in a scene that's not even all that suspenseful in the beginning until the battle starts. But I think that is one of the most perfectly just built scenes in terms of like direction, score, everything just coming together.
Well, and I there's a lead up to it. So you have the battle scene where the pace of things sort of increases, but you have this great sequence right before that, right, where the commander of the fleet comes down, and he wants to see how fast this thing can go. He's like, let's get this puppy up to different speeds. And so you have these scenes where the drumming starts at a slow pace and then just gradually increases to a frantic pace. And that builds the tension so much. And then there's this great release of it where there's this conversation between the characters. And then there's this other great explosion of it with the battles. And it's just like, it's the natural ebb and flow of breathe in, breathe out. And it does it so well. It's masterful. I mean, when we talk about one of the greatest film directors, this is why, because he takes a scene and he says, I'm going to build it, release it. Then I'm going to build it back up again so that it's even tighter for you when we have this climatic battle scene. And it's just really, really well done.
One of the little pieces of that scene that I love is that Wyler specifically will cut to other Roman centurions on there when you know Arius is sitting there and he's telling them to go faster, and the expressions on their face is like, man, this is cruel even for us.
Right. And it's kind of like scenes where you have like an engineer watching a machine and he's like at, like Scotty on this bridge of the Enterprise saying, I don't know if I can hold this thing together. And those soldiers are like, we don't know if these slaves can take this, you know? And in fact, some of them fall out and they just immediately replace them with somebody else. It's horrific. But at the same time, it shows you how strong Judah Ben-Hur as a character is too.
And then of course, you know, when the pirates, you know, are in sight and everything. And then of course there's the dread, you know, that the guys in the galley, you know, they're going to get rammed and most of these guys aren't going to survive and they know it. And just the whole panic of it all. And then of course you have the sequence where Arius, you know, unshackles Judah's feet so that when the time comes, he can't escape. And there's, you know, subtext in that as well. But that whole battle sequence, I mean, it was done with miniatures and a tank at MGM. And you can tell in certain pieces, but
even now in 2021, so this is a practical effect, and we're going to talk more about this too. Mm-hmm. You have to look very carefully to know that those are miniatures. And if you hadn't said that, I bet there's other people that'd be like, wow, they smashed up a lot of real ships.
Yeah.
Because those things are intricately done.
Yes.
And there are human-like figures on them that are so realistic that they look like figures shot in silhouette. There's only a very few times where you can look at those and say, oh, okay, I see it now. Those are carved out of wood or something similar.
Yeah, and that is the thing about this movie that always gets me when I watch it, the attention to detail in everything, you know, in costumes and in sets. I think I read, you know, these were some of the biggest sets that were ever built. And this movie was shot, you know, some of it was shot at MGM, but the majority of it was shot on location in Rome. And they built those sets on location in Rome. And I was doing some research and they said, as soon as they were done, they tore them all down because they said the minute the MGM crews had left Rome, they said there'd be a dozen Italian directors knocking each other over to film B movies on those sets.
Sure. Yeah. Hey, Hollywood came out here and built these. Yeah. This, I don't care what movie I'm making. It's now got a chariot race in it.
Yeah. So what's another favorite scene of yours?
I mean, I think it's now the time is right. We've got to talk about that chariot race scene, which is top to bottom, one of the greatest scenes in movie history. And watching it again, I'm still amazed. When you realize what the budget for this movie was, you look at that chariot race scene and you can say, well, sure, that's where they sunk a lot of it. Had it been done in 2012 or from that point forward in time, it would have been all computer graphics. None of it is. I mean, and none of it is even a screen of any kind or even a trick with plate glass. They built a real chariot coliseum and then they raced horses around it. From the minute those horses step on the field, you can see where they raked out the sand, and the footprints of the horses that are left there are the first time that sand has been touched. It's an amazing scene. It's like Lawrence of Arabia when they pan out and you see just these rows of footprints through the sand. And then they have these horses march in precision around the racetrack. It's before the race even gets started. This thing is an amazing spectacle. And then I still don't know how they filmed some of the action sequences during the chariot race. I think this was before any kind of Steadicam technology. But you have shots from over people's shoulders. You have them from the sides of a team of horse where you can see all four faces of the horses. I mean, they're just beautiful to witness. It's intense. It's gritty. It's dirty. It's amazing. I could go on for another half hour just talking about how great the sequences are.
What I found out is, well, first of all, we're in 1959. The majority of Americans have stopped going to the movies as much on a regular basis as they did before this, because TV has become a thing. Most people prefer to stay at home and, watch, something for free, And so Hollywood decided, we've got to do something to get these people. And so this is the era of widescreen, of, stereophonic sound, all this kind of stuff. And Ben-Hur takes advantage of those new technologies brilliantly. And the chariot race, of course, is the perfect example. But what I read is, because the speed of something is different coming at you as opposed to looking at something from the side, they would speed up some of the camera footage on some angles so that it all looked the same speed going at the same time. But that is really Charlton Heston and Stephen Boyd most of the time driving those chariots. They learned how to do that.
Amazing. Yeah.
They learned how, it's them. And then I believe they said five of some of Hollywood's greatest stuntmen, were doing that. And the chariot race, and I've got to give credit because they said, Wyler staged it and everything, but the actual stunts and everything was directed by a legendary stuntman and stunt coordinator named Yakima Canutt. And his son, Joe Canutt, was Charlton Heston's stunt double.
Oh, wow.
So they said the only time Heston really had a stunt double was when the horses would have to make, because it takes great precision to get all four horses to make a turn at that speed. So the stunt doubles for Stephen Boyd and Heston really were only responsible for doing the turns. And the rest of the time, it's Heston and Boyd. So that's pretty amazing. And apparently, Heston said that his little complaint to Wyler was, I just don't know if I have the stamina to get all this done. And he said, tell you what, Chuck, just stay behind there. And I guarantee as the director, you'll win the damn race.
Nice. I mean, when you talk about those stunt people too, there are scenes where there's no cut and there is a charioteer that flies through the air off of their chariot, lands on the ground, has the chariot go over them, and then they pop back up. I mean, these were tough individuals that were involved with this. And again, that's no dummy that they threw out there, and that's certainly not a computer effect. These were all real actors doing those things. So it's amazing.
And it just speaks to, and and I don't want to sound like an old fuddy-duddy because I'm not, but it speaks to, I don't know, I just feel like there's something about the level of craftsmanship that Hollywood was able to do at that time. And there's something about, I applaud, all the great computer graphic artists and everything, but the fact that all of this was built, all of this was practical, all of this is being filmed, everything is real in front of you in the scene. It makes it twice as exciting. And there's just something about, and those statues of the Roman gods that they built, they're like 30 feet high. And apparently those were made out of styrofoam, some kind of styrofoam substance, but they look like they were, granite and been sitting there for centuries.
Yeah.
But and there's, and that scene, there's so much at stake for so many people. There's Judah has something at stake. Masala has something at stake. The Sheik has something at stake. There's something, there's so much going on in that sequence. It's definitely top five, if not, top three, maybe the greatest action sequence ever made.
Well, and then it's the way they edit it so that it's intercut and you get pieces of those throughout, and how the tension builds from that too. It's in every Star Wars movie. I mean, that's, at the end of Star Wars where there's the Return of the Jedi, where there's a space battle going on and a land battle going on and a lightsaber battle. Those are the same thing, just in three different locations. And, you watch the one where there's pod racing. They're all callbacks to Ben-Hur. And there are so many other movies between here and there that did the same thing, that owe it to that very scene. It makes it, not only is it great, it's really an important scene for everything that came after in movie history.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Any other thing about the chariot race?
I mean, it just, if you do nothing else, and if you've seen Ben-Hur before and you don't want to sit through the 2.5 hours of the film again, go watch the 15-20 minute sequence of the chariot race scene. Mm. It'll blow your mind again. Even if you watch it on a phone, on a small screen, if you can get it up on something bigger, because that widescreen perspective is amazing. And I think correct me if I'm wrong too, this is like the only point in the movie where the score cuts out.
There's no score at all.
And to be able to get that level of tension without that is amazing. But there's this thrum, there's this horse hoof beat sound that goes on throughout the entire scene that is just amazing too. It gives it this bass note that just underscores the entire scene. And it's just a series of great choices all culminating.
And it leads into something that you and I referred to earlier, but one of the best death scenes, I think, in movie history. Also, the death of Missala. You know, we've got what we wanted. You know, Judah has embarrassed Missala, and I think the Sheik even mentions it in an earlier scene. You know, the greatest damage you can do to a Missala is have a Jew defeat him.
Yeah,
and so that's happened. But of course, Missala has not just been beaten; he's been ripped apart, basically.
Yes. And so when we see him, the doctor there is saying essentially to Missala, we have to get started now to remove your legs or you will not survive. And he's defiant. He's in great pain. His body's destroyed. And he said, nope, I'm waiting until Judah comes to visit me here. And eventually that's exactly what happens. And you get the great exchange and just the seething rage that Missala has during that scene, combined with the pain that he's in, it's a heart-wrenching scene.
And the way that Stephen Boyd does makes his voice, it sounds like all of his insides have been crushed. That he's because he can only just dredge up all the words that he is saying, and it's so great. And and of course he reveals to Judah on his deathbed, or whatever he's laying on, that his mother and sister, didn't die, that they're still alive, and go look for her and go look for them in the Valley of the Lepers. And it's, there's so much going on in that scene. And, these were two men who, were like brothers at one point. And, it's tragic, but, it's hopeful. And, there's so many things going on.
Yeah. And that's Missala getting his vengeance. That line about go find your family in the Valley of the Lepers. You're right. There's a whole lot of nuance going on, and it's played that way. It could easily go over the top, and it just never gets there. It gets right up to that line though, where, I know you aren't a big fan of how, Al Pacino in The Godfather Part 3 has this diabetic coma and he kind of overacts. You could easily have had something like that go on here.
Oh, yeah.
We
would have had to have had Lou come on for that.
Okay. Yeah. We don't want that. So.
No. No, but that leads into the last bit of the movie, and the scenes involving the leper, the Valley of the Lepers, I think is very well done. And it's so sad. I also think about, once, Judah goes back and gets his mom's sister and takes them back into town, they throw rocks at them and all that, like we said, so relevant of how people have been treated all the way down through the centuries, but,
including very recent history. I mean, communicable diseases. This is sort of a statement on those types of things too.
Yeah. So. I mean, it's a very heightened version of what we've been,
absolutely.
Cause they're kind of quarantined in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that leads, as you mentioned in your plot summary, to the, the whole crucifixion, sequence, and, it's funny because it takes Judah a while to recognize who he is until he finally gets face to face. And, and of course you have the wonderful parallel of him offering the water to Jesus, as he's fallen, on the road. And even though his mother and his sister Esther has seen him before, she's, the first sort of gateway that the family has into, the teachings of Jesus. But, the Miriam and Tirzah don't recognize him. They just pity him. Mm-hmm. And they feel something strong. And of course, that's what starts this whole section, but I think that whole sequence and even the crucifixion is just so well done, because once again, Jesus doesn't say anything. You don't see his face. You have that wonderful conversation between Balthazar and Judah. You know he didn't come for, you know, revenge to kill people. You know, this is what he came to do, so that, you know, we all can, you know, be redeemed and have life and all of that. And it's a beautiful, beautiful sequence.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when you think about how familiar that story is probably to lots and lots of people, and how you've pictured it in your mind, and I grew up Catholic and had to go to the Stations of the Cross. And so I know that story inside and out, and to see it play out on film in such a reverent way, but also through the eyes of these other characters that we've got to know along the way, is just a really great choice too. It's what keeps this movie from being preachy. It certainly has a message to it, but it's not in your face. Mm-hmm. It takes our character, our lead character of Judah Ben-Hur, to learn these lessons while watching this crucifixion, for him to get the message. That's when it finally comes out that that's what the message of this film is as well. And it's, and just well done.
And it leaves it to, you know, especially with Miriam and Tirza are cured of leprosy, it kind of leaves it up to the viewer, you know, is it because, you know, now that they've converted, are they followers now, or are they, you know, have they pitied him? Are they connecting, you know, to just, you know, the greater brotherhood of mankind, you know? And I read also that Wyler really, you know, wanted to make sure that everything was good. So he had a Catholic priest, a Protestant minister, a Jewish rabbi, everybody sort of look over to make sure that, you know, that this would be okay for, you know, any type of, you know, religion to view, that no one would be offended in any way or anything like that. And he does it. It's all directed in a very, very artistic, wonderful way.
Yeah. And I think one of the things, not just this last sequence, one of the things that's kind of cleverly done is, we kind of glossed over, there's the scene of the Sermon on the Mount, where everyone's gathering and Judah's invited to join Esther and Balthazar there to listen to the sermon. The thing is, we never hear the sermon. So the only time that we even, I think the word Jesus is spoken once in the film. Mm-hmm. And the only time that we even hear about his teachings is when Esther and Judah are together, sort of immediately before they go back to the valley. And she relays some of the parables from the Sermon on the Mount.
Yes.
So it's sort of a beautiful way to put those messages in this film without it being in your face or even subversive. You don't feel like you're getting tricked into it by any way either. It just happens to be a parallel story to Jesus's story.
Mm-hmm. And that final scene between Esther and Judah is wonderful, because during the whole Sermon on the Mount, he still hasn't, you know, gotten over, because what does he say? You know, he's gotten what he wants. You know, he's found, you know, he's figured out where his mother and sister are. Mathal is dead and everything. And he says, but I'm still thirsty.
That water is an amazing theme throughout this whole movie. And I think it culminates right there too.
Absolutely. And she even calls him out, you know, in that last scene, you know, you're no better than Masala now with your, you know, focus on revenge. And that's a wonderful, wonderful final moment. But yeah, it culminates so wonderfully. And of course the water plays out, you know, when the storm happens, and of course that's when they're cured of their leprosy. And you've got that, you know, running shot of just, you know, the water running through everything. It's a really, really well done movie.
Yeah.
And of course a wonderful final scene of him reuniting with his mother and his sister and Esther at the very end. Like you said, it doesn't quite put the button on the Esther and Judah relationship. We don't quite know what happened.
The ending's kind of abrupt. I mean, do you think that they're, all of the story arcs are kind of concluded, but it does kind of end abruptly. I mean,
somewhat. The interesting thing is, the producer of this movie, who was trying to get it backed for years, named Sam Zimbalist, passed away during the production of this movie. He had a fatal heart attack. And so a lot of people have said that had Sam Zimbalist lived throughout the whole thing, they think, first of all, maybe 15 minutes of the movie would have been cut. And then a few other, there were some subplots and everything that had got, that were kind of peppered in that never got quite completed and all that. So a lot of people have suggested that. But yeah, it does end a little bit abruptly.
Yeah.
And that might be one of the things about the movie that, that doesn't work for me. And then, but really for a, you know, 3.5 more movie, it really moves well. I don't think I don't think it drags in too many places. You know, we talked about in Spartacus at times feels a little long, and I think it's because it's just so bogged down with so much action and everything. Whereas in Ben-Hur, you get more time to really get to know the characters, and so you're involved a little bit more than maybe you are in Spartacus.
Yeah, yeah, and it doesn't feel like a slog even on a rewatch. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a long movie; it's a commitment. And I think I mentioned this to you one time before. I've never seen this movie straight through.
Yeah,
I've always just what's the old phrase? How do you eat an elephant? You bite it off in chunks. I had to do this with this movie. There is a nice natural break. They put an intermission in this film. Doesn't feel like a slog, but you do have to have the time to sit down and watch it.
I would love to see it on a big screen one day, because you know, that's how movies like this definitely are meant to be seen. So hopefully at some point I can, or they'll bring it back. Is there anything else? You know, we talked about, you know, Heston, you know, just his whole performance is a little much for you sometimes. Is there anything about the movie that doesn't work for you?
You know, no. I mean, I think most of the rest of the movie works. And I think there are other problematic things in the movie that we didn't really touch on. And there's particularly a dance number when they're in Rome that is all, you know, I'm not even sure what they would have considered the dancers to be, but they're all dark-skinned dancers. That is a little questionable on how that scene is presented. I'd be hard-pressed to say, here's where you could trim 15 minutes from this movie.
Right.
It would probably be an easier pill to swallow if it was, but there's not a whole lot of fat on this thing. Mm-mm. So, hey, 11 Academy Awards can't be wrong either. No. Here, you know, and I'm sure we're going to get into that in a minute. It's a good movie start to finish. So there's not too much I would beat it up over. I've already given my sort of negative views and would stand by those, but no, there's nothing else I would ding it for.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much. It's a very well-written screenplay, and the Carl Turnberg is the main person who gets the credit for writing the screenplay, but there were several writers that were credited as having contributed, including Gore Vidal at one point. So there were a lot of hands that were part of it, but I think it's a well-written screenplay, and like we said, because of the artistry of the people that were behind the movie, it really, really has so much humanity that, you know, a lot of big epics might not have had. Just wanted to give credit to the cinematographer, Robert Surtees, who,
yes, indeed.
This is a beautifully shot movie. So many rich colors and so many people to get, so many extras to get on screen.
And we hadn't even mentioned that yet. Yeah. I mean, there are times when there's 100 horn players on the screen. I mean, that is just people playing the horn, you know, and those scenes of the crowds for the parades, the chariots, you can tell there are thousands of extras on set at any given time. So the costuming had to have been crazy. The props had to have been crazy. No wonder it was such an expensive film to make.
Yeah, and apparently costume designer Elizabeth Haffenden oversaw a staff of 100 wardrobe fabricators to make the costumes, and a workshop of employing over 200 artists and workmen provided the 100 of statues also needed for the film.
Wow.
So, and also, this was at a time when the studio system was still going pretty strongly, and so they were factories. They just, you know, put one movie out one at a time, and so a lot of times movies only took a few months to make. This movie took 2 years to make.
Right.
And so this was not an easy shoot. You know, Heston, I said, you know, there were some really rough days when we thought this thing was never going to get made, just because, first of all, Wyler was a perfectionist and, you know, required a lot of retakes. And so finally MGM, because they were going way over budget, they said, you've got to come back to, you know, California and finish this up, because we can't fund you anymore in Rome, just because, you know, MGM was low on funds at that time anyway.
Well, and they paid a pretty penny to get Wyler to do this too, correct?
Yeah,
if I remember correctly, they offered him $1 million, which was the first time that any director had received mm-hmm. a $1 million plus salary to do a film.
And they had originally, I think they had offered it to David Lean, who had just gotten done with Bridge on the River Kwai, but he was so tired from that, and I think he was already in pre-production for Lawrence of Arabia. He said, I can't do one of these in the middle.
I couldn't even imagine, no.
But yeah, so the budget of this movie, which for 1959, you got to remember, pretty astronomical, $15.2 million. But the box office for this movie in its initial release alone was $146 million.
Holy cow.
So this, and it was
to come back almost 10 times over your budget. You risk it all, you get it all. Basically, this saved the studio.
And the second highest grossing film of all time, second to Gone with the Wind at that time. And then a few years later, a movie that we talked about back in January, The Sound of Music, would rank right up there too. So the late 50s, early 60s was really a time when Hollywood was really churning out big movies mm-hmm. like this. And, you know, I kind of miss, you know, we get big blockbusters, but we don't get a whole lot of spectacle anymore. And I kind of, you know, if spectacle is done well, like it is in this movie, there's nothing like it. It's such an experience. But we were right when you mentioned 11 Oscar nominations. It's interesting, even though MGM was struggling at the time, in 1958 and 1959, it did pretty well at the Oscars, because Gigi had won Best Picture the year before in 1958. And that was a movie that went incredibly over budget. But thank goodness, you know, once again was a big hit. And, you know, just preview, we'll be talking about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So tune in next month, correct?
We'll be discussing Gigi. Next one. Nominated for 12 Oscars and won at the time an unprecedented 11. One Best Picture, Best Director for Wyler, Best Actor for Heston, Supporting Actor for Hugh Griffith, Set Direction, Cinematography, Costume Design, Special Effects, Film Editing, Music, and Sound.
Wow. I mean, yeah, and that's all the biggies, basically, too. You know, not a lot of strong female roles in this one, mm-hmm. so they couldn't get those. But those are, you know, pretty much all the technical ones that I could think of. But then to get picture director and leading actor and supporting actor is huge.
And the only one it lost was Best Adapted Screenplay, which it lost to Room at the Top, which was a French film. And a lot of people, I think, have attributed that to the fact that there was a lot of controversy over the screenplay as to who contributed what. Mm-hmm. So that it kind of lost that. But because of the 11 wins, it's tied for the most wins, along with Titanic and Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. So mm-hmm. three huge epic movies.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah. And, you know, when you look at both of those other movies, you can see a lot of this movie in it. I mean, Titanic goes so much to those ocean sequences in Ben-Hur, and Lord of the Rings, all the sequences of armies moving on horseback, all CGI done, by the way, for Lord of the Rings, but very much go back to the chariot races and the horses in this Ben-Hur movie. So kind of a neat parallel to those two other films that tie the record for Academy Awards.
Definitely. And, you know, once again, it's appeared on a lot of different lists over the years. It's been, you know, part of the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress, on the American Film Institute, number 72 on the list of 100 greatest films, 49 on the most thrilling films of all time, 21 on the greatest film scores of all time, number 56 on the most inspiring movies of all time, and number 2 on the greatest epics of all time.
Yeah. And I think that's right. I mean, I would certainly put this in the top 100 greatest films.
Oh yeah.
I already told you it's not my favorite. So it certainly doesn't break my into my top 10. But it's definitely one of the best made movies that is out there. You can argue whether it's one of the best acted or not, but there's certainly moments where it's really, really, really well acted.
Yeah, just for the production alone.
Indeed,
it's gotta rank up there. And just for the chariot sequence alone, it's gotta rank up there because it's such a masterfully put together sequence. And you know, and the whole galley sequences, I think, are right up there too. I mean, there's so much going on in this movie that was, you know, that this movie could have been. Had it failed, you know, there would be, you know, a parking lot where MGM Studios used to be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and because it was such a huge, huge hit. I mean, and this is one of the first movies also we didn't talk about, but they did merchandising. I mean, there was, you know, perfumes and clothing and, you know, dolls and everything, you know, that went along with Ben-Hur, you know, not too many movies aside from maybe Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind did that kind of merchandising. And so, you know, movies by this time were starting to become a really sort of, merchandising frenzy, you know, kind of the way they are now. So it also led the way in that respect. So a lot started with Ben-Hur.
I'm going to try to find some Ben-Hur perfume then for my wife. That's, I can't imagine what that smells like.
But I have no idea. And of course, you know, we talk about this was an epic done right, but, you know, 4 years later, another epic of this size, Cleopatra, almost brought down a studio.
Yes, indeed. And that's an epic done wrong. I mean, I shouldn't say that.
I don't think it's a bad movie.
It's not. And that's on our list. We will get to that one as well.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
That's much aligned because of the budget.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It just shows you when a budget is used correctly and when it's used incorrectly.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I love epics. You know, a lot of times you can't sit down and watch them in, you know, one sitting, but boy, when they are done right, there's nothing quite like them, you know. And I would even guess, you know, The Godfather's an epic to me, kind of. It's a lot, you know. And then you have movies like How the West Was Won, and, you know, really something that takes, you know, someone that likes to tell, like, the story of most of the time, like a family, and you go generation by generation, and at the end of 3 hours, you know, and even like in Gone with the Wind, you feel like you've lived life with these people.
Yeah,
and,
no,
and that's kind of what you feel at the end of this movie.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
So as we close here, Eric, final thoughts on Ben-Hur?
Yeah, I think we've said it over and over again. It's definitely on a must-watch list. Some of the greatest film ever produced is in the second half of this movie with the chariot race. So see it for that, if nothing else. But it's also it's a well-done story. It's a familiar story. I feel like, too, like we mentioned it earlier, that the Ten Commandments every Easter was on network TV. I feel like this one made the rounds on sort of cable television around Easter time all the time, too. So it's not hard to come by. Commit to it. You know, give yourself the couple of what'd you say? It's like 3.5 hours to actually get through the. You know what you can do, though, is DVR the thing and then fast forward through the overture and the interact. So that'll save you 15 minutes. That's our little tip for you on this one. But yeah,
if you're into movie scores, though, you'll want to listen to the overture.
Yeah, true.
Yeah,
true.
It just depends.
Yeah. So just tons of great pieces that come together and work.
Yeah. To me, this is even if this isn't your favorite movie necessarily, it's a landmark. And it's a landmark that isn't just, you know, just there for historical purposes. It's a movie that still works. Mm-hmm. And it's a movie that's still exciting. I dare you to not watch, you know, the chariot sequence or the galley sequences and not, you know, be thrilled by it, because it still holds up to this day. And it's a well-told story. And it's very inspirational. And at the end, you really feel joy with these people, you know, the fact that, you know, they've gotten through this sort of cloud of, you know, vengeance that's been hanging over their heads, and they're sort of being led to freedom in their own way. And it really is a very, very touching ending in a way that not a lot of epics, but by the end of a lot of epics, you kind of just feel exhausted. But at the end of Ben-Hur, you feel very inspired. And yeah, I think that's why it holds up and is still one of the best.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
So as we continue on, Eric, we've got a lot coming up here. First of all, April, we've got two great interviews coming up. We're going to be talking to Jeremy Arnold, who is the author of TCM, The Essentials, Volume 1 and Volume 2. And we're going to get to pick his brain. And I think that's going to be a fun interview because you and I have talked about a lot of these movies that are in his book. Some we haven't and are on our list to talk about, but I think it's going to be cool to pick his brain to see, you know, exactly why he put them in the book and why he thinks they're essential.
Yeah. And the I've got Volume 1 and I keep going back to it. It's kind of set up where it gives little bits of each movie. If I put it down, I keep thinking about, well, what's that next movie? And I keep going back to it. So it's going to be great to talk to him about that book.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. And then also we're welcoming back someone who we've had on before, Patricia Ward Kelly, who's going to come on. It's the 70th anniversary of An American in Paris. And it's going to be great to talk to her. We got to talk to her about Jean as a whole and Jean's life last time, but to talk to her about a specific movie and to be able to go into detail that way is just going to be great.
Yeah, and what a great movie and what a great thing to do it on its 70th anniversary. That'll be a lot of fun.
And then we alluded to it earlier, but we did a Best Picture poll a couple months ago, and the winner was Gigi, the movie that won Best Picture the year before this one. And it's a musical, just like An American in Paris, and directed by Vincent Minnelli. We didn't plan it that way, but
people voted on it. We're giving the people what they want. Yeah, here,
and so. And both starring Leslie Caron. So yeah, there's a lot of connections with these two movies. And it's going to be – I haven't watched Gigi in a while, and Allison's going to join us for that. And there's a lot of great things in it, and it's a very, very interesting movie to talk about.
Yeah, looking forward to that as well.
Yeah, so man, I mean, we're rolling along here in 2021 and just excited for what's coming up.
Same. I mean, would like to point out though that if anybody has a movie that they want us to discuss, we are taking requests. So if you have a notion, we'd invite you on the podcast to come talk about it too. So we've got a couple of those in the works too, right, Brandon? Not stuff we're ready to reveal yet, but
not yet. But yeah, some great requests. We always get a couple requests from our hosts of the front row, so you never know if we'll work one of those in, but also people outside of the front row, which is exciting.
And they can get a hold of us a couple of different ways, right? What are the best ways for folks to get a hold of us here at the Front Row
Network? You can email us directly, classicsfrn@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook at the Front Row Classics podcast page. And you can also find us on Instagram at FRN Classics Pod. And any of those ways, just get a hold of us. I check them regularly. And so our February episode of His Girl Fridays, one of our fans messaged us, and we grabbed a couple of the front row hosts, and that was one of our best episodes of the year so far. As long as it's silent era through the 70s, otherwise we're moving in on other host territory, and we don't want to do that.
Yeah. They get sensitive.
Yeah. Awesome. So as we close out this episode of Front Row Classics, I am Brandon Davis.
And I'm Eric Flick.
And we will see you in the front row.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on them with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the front row.